Hi, my name is Marjorie. I'm an addict. This is the 50th Anniversary History Conference in Nashville, Tennessee, October 3rd to the 5th, 2003. The recordings from this conference belong to the public domain. The next speaker is Sally E. Sally E., 29 Palms, California. Sally has been clean since September 1st, 1969. Some of her service positions throughout the years include World Service Board of Trustees, 1997, re-elected in 1984 for a total of 9 years, Vice Chair 1 year, Chair for 2 years, World Service Office Board of Directors 2 years, World Literature Committee 4 years, Basic Tech, Tradition Section, N.A. Way Editorial Board 3 years, and collaborated for 2 years on a staff and tradition book that has yet to be published. Please introduce. Let's welcome Sally E.
Hi, my name is Sally, and I'm an addict. And I'm really glad to be here. You know, some people have asked about, at the end, there's usually done a question about what was the person's vision for Narcotics Anonymous. And a lot of times people have said things better than we ever could say or I ever could say to them. And there was a guy who's not alive today who said his vision for Narcotics Anonymous years ago. And when he said it, I went, yes. And he talked about Martin Luther King's I have a dream speech. And Chuck Skinner would say, I have a dream, and my dream is that no addict ever die who's seeking recovery. No addict never die without having had exposure to Narcotics Anonymous anywhere in the world. And that was his vision, and I bought that 100%. Couple of things. I got clean in 1969, and I was incredibly sick. I mean, just incredibly sick. I'm 6 feet tall, and I weighed 115 pounds, and I wore a size 6. I weigh 150 today, and I'm not exactly real chubby, so you can imagine what I looked like. I couldn't stop shaking. I couldn't hold down solid food. I saw things that weren't there. I heard things that weren't there, and I felt things that weren't there. I always thought throughout my using that I, you know, there were a lot of times when I really tried to stay clean, and sometimes I would get like a few months, a few weeks, 6 months one time, and that was always without any kind of a program. And I would always start experiencing this anxiety. You know what I'm talking about? Terrible anxiety. And I would think that I am going to go crazy. And when I would reach that point, I would use. Well, it was a great comfort. I found out that anxiety didn't mean that I was going to go crazy. After I really went crazy, I knew what that was like. I never had to worry about that if I didn't use it again. So in my early recovery, I had a lot of that anxiety, but I knew I wasn't going to go crazy because I had gone crazy. I don't know if that makes any sense to anybody, but it sure made sense to me. When I came into Narcotics Anonymous, they told me that women didn't make it. That they told me that you have 2 chances, slim and none. And I kept coming back, and I kept coming back, and I shook, and I jerked, and I, you know, twitched, and I had seizures. And I started putting together some time. And I did some panels. I tried to start a meeting in Orange County twice. And I sat with the little white pamphlet at a table with this other guy that I roped into it, and we gave it 6 months, and then we just got sick, so sick of each other that we called it quits. And then another 6 months, 8 months went by, and I tried it again, and this time this guy told me, I ain't doing that. So I sat there with myself for 6 months, and I used to go to the business meetings, and I would say, well, I'm in the Tustin meeting. And I was the whole Tustin meeting. And after another six, I gave it 6 months again, and once in a while somebody would wander in, and I'd try to 12-step them into the program, but I don't know, they just never stayed. And so eventually so I gave that up, and I just started going to meetings. I always went to the 11th and Rao meeting in Manhattan Beach. It was a meeting started by Jack Whaley and Chuck Skinner. And I went to the La Mirada meeting, which was started by Mel. And I started putting together some time and getting better. And I got to tell you that it's always been very hard for me to talk. I have severe asthma, and I get a little nervous, and my bronchioles close up, and it's difficult for me to talk. And, you know, I just usually struggle through it. I don't send tapes to any conventions because I really don't want to be asked. But if I'm really asked, I'll do that. I'll do what I'm asked to do, and I'll try to do it to the best of my ability. You know, I follow basketball, and there's a guy on the Lakers, or used to be a guy on the Lakers, who played for the Chicago Bulls. His name was Ron something. Harper, he like stuttered, and they would always interview him after the games, and he would always stutter, and he had a very hard time with it. And I really related to that guy that he just tried to do it, and that's what I do. I try to do it, and I do the best of my ability. And if I run into difficulty, I run into difficulty. This is a history conference, and I've been asked to speak about some very specific things. And a lot of people have talked about or alluded to people stealing money. I never heard that about Jimmy. I heard that about just about everybody else. And there's probably a guy here that I've heard that about a lot. Like world literature? Is Bo, are you here? Well, I heard that about Bo a lot. And I got to tell you, through the process of world literature, I watched Bo get poorer and poorer and poorer. And I never saw anybody that was accused of stealing, driving a Mercedes. I never saw them doing really well. So I don't think that there's any basis in fact to those rumors about any of us. I think all of us who've been in service do the best we can. We do the very best we can to the best of our ability. And it may not be very good in other people's eyes, but it's the best we can do. And we may get criticized for it, but it isn't about being criticized for. You just do what you can, and you do the best to the best of your ability, and you walk away and you can feel good about yourself, or you can feel like, well, yeah, maybe I could have done it better, or maybe I could have done this, or maybe I should have done this, but at the time, I did the very best I could. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the early history. You know, we all have these little pieces of facts and these little interesting little things and these fun little things that happened. Some of you may have heard the tape from the 20th anniversary banquet of Narcotics Anonymous. Yeah, I see some people nodding. Jimmy spoke, and Chuck spoke, and Jack spoke, and I squeaked for about 5 minutes, I think. Oh, that was very bad shape that day. And afterwards, and Jack gave a very spiritual talk, and afterwards he got in a fist fight with the guy across the I'm not kidding, he did. It was a fist fight all the way across the floor, over the moat. It was a real fancy restaurant, a little moat. And a bridge and stuff out into the street. And he had called me about a week before that, and he hadn't had a suit in like 15 years, and he wanted to buy a suit to talk at this thing. And so we went down to the garment district, and he tried on suits, and he was really proud of his new suit. Well, it had the sleeve ripped off of it, the collar torn. We could be a little rough back then. We all have, like, different sides to us. And there was nobody more abrasive at times than Jack Whaley. Would you all, people who knew him, agree with that? But there was also nobody more gentle, nobody more loving, nobody more caring. If I was in trouble and he knew it, he would call me up. He cut hair. And he'd say, come on up, I'll cut your hair and you'll feel better. Or come on up, we'll go for a walk. One time, I'm going to tell you about Jack Wheeler's story. One time, I had this boss, and he was like, you know, he was really a jerk. Like, he probably wasn't more than five, he was just slightly over 5 feet. And one, yeah, you know right away. Once he started there, he didn't hire anybody over 5 feet. If he had anything to say to me, he waited until I was sitting down or sent somebody else over to say it. And if he came over and I was sitting down, he'd walk back and forth on his elevator shoes and holler at me. And I know, like, he was trying to list me out, and I was complaining about it. And he had a birthday party, and I wasn't going to go to this blankety-blank birthday party. And I was talking to Jack about it, and Jack said, well, if you're so smart and he's so dumb and awful, how come he's the boss and you're the peasant? And he says, oh, you need to go to that birthday party. And I go, nah, I don't want to go. And he said, look, I'm going to come pick you up after work and we're going to go to that birthday party. So I said, okay. And you're going to get him a present, too. I go, okay. Okay. And that was the neat side of Jack Whaley. Well, there was this guy who was just delightful. He was a little gay guy, and he was like real enthusiastic and really cute. I mean, he was just cute. And we were good friends, and he wasn't going to go to the party either. And I told him what Jack said, and he said, well, I'll go if I can go with you. So Jack comes over, and this guy gets in the back, and Jack's got this car that he just bought, and we're driving down the freeway. And he gets in a hassle with a double gasoline truck. The guy's like right on her tail, and then he comes up, and Jack puts on his brakes, and I mean, you know, one of those road rage kind of things. And this guy jumps up, and the gasoline truck is coming over into the lane, and Jack's not moving. And this guy in the back seat going, stop it, he's going to kill us. And I'm going, I never made Jack, nobody could make Jack Whaley do anything. So he scrapes us all the way, I'm just framed by this time. He scrapes us all the way down the side and then backs off, and Jack says, yes, I showed him who had balls. That was the marvelous side of Jack, and that was the side that he needed a little abrasive there. Jack took me up to see Jimmy when I had about 3 weeks. For some reason, Jack and a guy by the name of Dave Brown kind of adopted me. I don't know, I guess Jack thought I was as screwed up as he was when he came in. Maybe not quite as bad, but pretty close. So I tapped something in him, and he kind of adopted me. Anyway, he said, I'm going to take you up, and you're going to meet the guy who's responsible for your opportunity to recover. And I was really excited. Sounded like you're going to meet God. And we went up there, and Jimmy told me about women not making it in Narcotics Anonymous, and about the ones that did. And he talked about that, and he said, you know, when sometimes they do and they get a couple of years and then they go to another 12-step program. And he said, don't do that. And I told him, I was really an AA reject. They didn't like me at all. I mean, they really didn't. I think I talked about that on Thursday, how I used to fear the rose around me when I go to an AA meeting when I was trying to make it. I mean, I fear the teacher and teacher. I think I scared him because I was so nuts. And the way I got here was somebody in AA said, you know, there's a place for people like you. That's how I got here. She's a little old lady with blue hair and, you know, pearls and polyester dress. Anyway, she gave me a name and number of somebody from Narcotics Anonymous. And when I called them, it came to me. So I went up to meet Jimmy. Jimmy was really nice to me. But Jimmy was messed up, man. I mean, like, he was, like, all beat up. And he had a black eye, bruises all over. Finally, I was looking at him, you know. And finally, I got enough nerve to say, are you okay? And he said, yeah, I'm fine, man. I said, well, did you have an accident? And he said, no, I got in a fist fight with some 20-year-old in an auto parts store. I mean, that's the human side. And a lot of times I hear people talked about and kind of idealized. And we're all very human. And we all have, like, really great things about us. And we all have some things that, well, the next time I heard Jimmy talk a lot, and when he talked about the steps, and when he talked about the traditions, something very magical happened. I mean, he really knew the steps, and he knew the traditions, and he could really impart that, and I hope that there's a lot of tapes around about that, because he was really wonderful when he did that. Next time I'm in the Tustin meeting and I'm going to the business meeting and I get my old beater car up there. I have this old beater and a lot of the guys in the program worked on it, you know, after I got it to a meeting and couldn't get it back. I don't think I had a car that was under, you know, I paid $100 for this one and run it to the ground and then get another one for $150 or whatever. But that's, anyway, a lot of them worked on my car. Bob Barrett worked on my car a lot. Chuck let me sleep on his couch until the next day when I could get the car started, because sometimes it started better in the daytime than it did at night. So anyway, I got my old beater up there, and it was this business meeting. And the rent for the business meeting included the coffee. But the coffee, I didn't make coffee at the time. I didn't get that habit till later. But the coffee was wretched. I mean, they just said it was just absolutely undrinkable. So Jimmy's going on and on about coffee, and up coffee, and up coffee. And, you know, I'm like kind of an impatient person. And I came up there, and I want to take care of business, and I want to go. And I'm tired of the coffee. So I walked down the street a couple blocks to this little store. And I'm like, as soon as you have coffee, I can find your feet. It'll get them through a while, and then we can move on here. And I brought it back, and Jimmy goes, it's not about the coffee, it's the principle of the matter. So I thought about that all the way home, and I called Jack, and I said, Jack, what principle was involved? And I didn't understand this. And he says, oh, Jimmy was just being cantankerous. And he had a cantankerous side to him, just like we all have, you know, our little blind spots and our little things we do that aren't. None of us are God. We're all just struggling addicts trying to stay clean a day at a time. And so we all have our little things. Anyway, so that was pretty much my experience with Jimmy until I got involved in World. And, you know, when I had a few years clean, I had this really low, I waited tables. And there was a time when I didn't want to do that anymore. I don't know, there was something that just happened, and I think that God helped me become extremely dissatisfied with that, because there was something more I was meant to do. And I would cry all the way to work. And then I would get to work and I would be okay. And then I would cry all the way home because I would think that I had to do that the rest of my life and I didn't want to do it. And somebody said, well, why don't you go to school? And I said, because I'm dumb. You know, I never did well in school, and I didn't think that I had the mental ability to do it. And I had a friend, and she was registering for school, and she dragged me with her. She said, well, come with me while I'm registering, and then we'll talk about some of the problems that you're experiencing and some of the pain you were going through. And I was going through a lot of pain there. And you know what the real miracle of it was? I didn't want to use. And I didn't want to kill myself. I just wanted to find a way out. And as she was registering, she said, why don't you register? And I said, well, because it's too late. And the lady behind the desk said, no, it isn't. Here are the papers. And that's how I ended up in school. And I graduated, I got my AA degree, and then I transferred into UCI, and when they accepted me, I couldn't believe it. Are these people nuts or what? And I graduated from UCI. And when I started going to school, I was working full time. I was going to school, and I didn't have a lot of time for anything else. I made a couple of meetings a week. I sponsored a couple of people. I sponsored a couple of people that helped me. And I did what I could, but it wasn't a lot. You know, I feel like those 4 years that I went to school, I took a lot, and I didn't give a lot back. And then after I got my degree, a guy by the name of Greg, who wrote The Tree and a lot of the literature and a lot of the stuff that's in the tradition section of the book. I'm right about that, out in Tybo. Yeah, it always looked to me like great stuff. He never owned it or never said that it was his, but you know, you kind of know people's writing. And he came up to me and he said, Sally, you know, you've been taking a lot and you haven't been given a lot back. And I think it's time for you to do that. And there aren't any women on the trustees who are active at this time, and we'd really like you to be on the board of trustees. And I said I would. And so that sort of began an adventure in recovery, let's call it. That was a wonderful, exciting time. I made friends all over the country. It was a painful time. It was a divisive time. It was a sad time. It was a happy time. It was a whole lot of stuff. Sometimes I ask them for tissue because I probably will cry as I talk about some of this stuff. But it was like, you know, when I first got clean, I always heard about our book. And it was always like, who's writing our book? And I always expected that Jimmy would form some kind of a committee and he would write our book. And somewhere along the line, this is hearsay, so I don't know if this is exactly true or if this really happened, but Jack and Chuck told me about it. And somebody came with another 12-step fellowships book, and it was adapted to Narcotics Anonymous. And I guess they wanted to see permission from the World Service Office of another 12-step fellowship for this book. And the idea was really mixed because it was thought like we needed our own book and our own literature and our own words. And I always thought somebody was working on it somewhere. And I kept waiting for this book that never came. Like kind of like waiting for Godot. It's a play about a guy who spent his whole life on a street corner waiting for God. So when, so anyway, that's kind of how it felt like, you know, this book's never going to happen. And we always called it our book. It was our book. Where is our book? And then there's a couple of things that happened that were kind of just awesome. The first convention that went out of California, you know, it was either Southern California or Northern California that had the World Convention. And the first convention that went out of California was a God moment. It really was. San Francisco had a very elaborate package. And I think it was it Santa Monica that had an elaborate package? Or it was some place in Southern California that had an elaborate package. Santa Monica, that's what I thought. And the vote was tied. It was just tied. And they took another vote, and it was tied. And people were screaming at each other, George, come over here. You know, they had them on one side of the room over here. Come over here. I'll take it. Disneyland. Put you up at my house. I'll pay you. Someone else, you can go in my car. And that somebody from Texas got up and said, we're a small fellowship. We don't have an elaborate package like y'all. We're just a small, struggling fellowship, and we haven't got that many meetings. But if y'all come to Texas, we'll show you a good time, Texas style. And the convention went to Texas. No package, no nothing. They didn't know what hotel they were going to put anybody up in. They didn't know if they were going to find a place, but it went there on faith. And sometimes when push comes to shove, we really have faith. We just have faith. And it carries us through. I went to San Diego. When I went to San Diego, that was the first convention I'd been to in almost 10 years. Southern California, I think in 95 or 96, was the last convention. And what would happen to me when I would go to conventions is I'd only have like 50% of the lung capacity I should have at my age and stuff. And part of that is from the abuse, and part of that is from having severe asthma. And I would always go to a convention, and I would always get sick from the secondhand smoke afterwards. And so I stopped going. And when they called me and asked me to participate in that thing, I told them I don't think I can because I'm going to breathe a lot of secondhand smoke and I'm really going to get sick. And they promised me I wouldn't. They put me in the hotel across the street so that I didn't have to walk that far. So there wasn't that much on the street, and then inside, you know, you could, so I stayed away from it, and I didn't get sick, and it was the first time I'd been to a convention and not gotten sick. I went through a pulmonary rehab program, and I know this is side stuff that sometimes people maybe don't want to hear, but I went through a pulmonary rehab program, and they taught me what I needed to do to function optimally. And at first I did the program. I can't believe the steps. I did everything on it. And it worked. You know, and I have a really nice quality of life because I really made a surrender there and I did what they said and I worked the steps. I had the steps. I am so grateful. I had the steps to apply to another disease. Anyway, that's the side thing. Is Jean here? We went up to Oregon, to Ashland, for the first NA convention outside of California. It was in Ashland, Oregon, and we decided we wanted to support them and go up there. And we all had it. This is crazy. This is the insanity. We all had enough money to buy a regular ticket, but we were cheap. And a guy by the name of Bob B. knew somebody that had a twin-engine Cessna that would be glad to take us up there for $100 a piece, round trip. And so we were like, oh yeah, sign me up. And so we all got on this plane, and it seated six, and there were seven of us, so there was a milk carton in the middle of the aisle. And we were flying up there, and one of the engines quit. And then we went into a dive, and then we pulled out of it, and the engine kicked back in. And then we went into another dive and pulled out of it. And then we went into a big dive, and both engines quit. And the pilot, buzzers are going off, and the pilot goes, "Oh, shit!" And I'm like, "Oh, my God." I mean, I remember surrender. I got by the name of Bill H. And we both looked at each other and we went like, "Okay, here we go. This is it." You know, I just surrendered. I knew it was over. And I was okay with that. And then it pulled out. We had a great time at the convention, wonderful time. And you know what? Every one of us got back on that freaking plane. That's insane. That's nuts. Every one of us. One of the people and I talked about it years later. We go, I can't believe it. I'm about to take the Greyhound bus today. I would rent a car if I could. I would do anything, but I would not get back on that plane. And of course, every little, you know, turbulence we hit, we would go, Anyway, that's just the little terrifying story that I couldn't resist telling. I guess I want to talk about the miracle of the book. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to without crying. I came home from, I haven't been on the trustees that long. I came home from work and there was I was planning to eat dinner and go to a meeting. And there was a Memphis, a Gray book called the Memphis, I think it was called, we called it the Memphis Review Copy. And it was a book. And I was so excited. I forgot about dinner. I forgot about everything. And I was sitting down with this book. And there was a little cover letter that said, if you saw any place that needed changing, if you saw any place that needed modifying, to feel free to do that and to let them know. And so I sat down with this and I was like, so I looked at the first paragraph and I spent almost 3 hours rewriting that. And then I thought, you know what? I better look at the rest of these churches. I mean, there were pages without paragraphs. There were run-on sentences. There were things that didn't make any sense at all. And I was like, oh my God, this is awful. This is really terrible. You know, several years later, I talked to a lady that was there when they put that Memphis Review copy together. And I said, Mary, and she was an English teacher. I said, Mary, I don't understand how that happened. And she said, well, I was pretty new, and we were just so excited about getting out something, anything. And I kept saying, well, this doesn't make sense here. And they'd say, oh, somebody out there will fix it. So, so I decided the Santa Monica Literature Conference was coming, and I decided that somebody needed to take on the thankless job of going and telling them about professional writers and professional editors. And I didn't see anybody else. I talked to, I think, Chuck, a couple other people, and I didn't see anybody else who was willing to do it, so here I am. And I arrived, you know, the traffic in L.A. is just rigid. So I got off work and I got there, but I got there late. And when I got there, they were like already doing their thing, so I didn't really have the opportunity to present my great plan. And Bo came running up to me and he said, hi, I'm Bo. And I said, hi, Bo. And he said, y'all type? And I type, yeah. You know, maybe 30 words a minute with 18 errors. So I said, no, Bo, I don't type. So, well, do y'all read and write? I go, yeah, Bo, I can read and write. said, well, y'all want to put them on the input screening committee. I go, what's that? So, well, that's where we take all the input that came in about the Memphis Review copy and decide what chapter it belongs in. I said, okay, that sounds like something I can do. So I'm on this input screening committee, and this stuff, some of it was written on napkins, some of it was unreadable, and I'm like, so, throw that away. No, somebody rescues it. Yeah, we don't throw anything away. I said, but I can't read it. And they look out and they say, well, let's put it in this pile. Okay. And then the next day I came in, I got to work on the cut and paste committee. You know, they just took the stuff that came in that belonged to that particular chapter and just cut it and pasted it all together. And I'm just going, oh my God. The next day, Bo asked me, how would you like to work on the catchphrase committee? I go, catchphrase committee? What's that? So that's where you think about little catchy phrases, and then we'll make a big list of them and sprinkle them through the book. I go, excuse me, I think I'll pass on that one. No, I don't want to do that. Later, when we were editing the book, there were things like, as you work this stuff, your troubles will melt away like an iceberg in the tropics. Or how about, the fourth step is a wondrous journey. Please. Not mine. I don't think I've met too many people that their fourth step was a wondrous journey, but I mean, maybe the end, but I don't know. Anyway, that I passed on that committee. I started working on an edit committee, and they took the first chapter. They had the first chapter finished, and they took this first chapter, and they rang the bell, and everybody who was there gathered around the table, and they passed out copies of this chapter to everybody. And they got up and they said, line one, page one, paragraph one, sentence one. Read, does anybody have any changes? And somebody said, yeah, I think that sentence ought to read da 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 on the board. Oh, I think that sentence ought to read da 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 on the board. And then they voted. And that's how that book was written. And I'm just like, huh? I was incredulous, just incredulous. They had a 45-minute debate in Santa Monica over the word chronic. The disease is chronic, progressive, and fatal. Some people thought the word chronic was too medical and didn't belong in there. And other people felt it adequately, accurately described the disease. Debate went on for 45 minutes. And I'm like, throw out the sentence, throw out the page, I don't care, just move on. Just please. Chronic made it into the book, as you probably, most of you know. But that was the process by which that book was written. And when that chapter was finalized, I went, you know, this isn't half bad. This isn't too bad. I couldn't believe that could happen. That the book could actually, you know, committees don't like books. So I'm hooked. I'm really hooked. So the next one is in Ohio, and I bring out my trusty credit card and I go to Ohio. And, you know, there's a lot of things that happened with writing that, in the process of that book, and a lot of miracles. And in Ohio, we were divvying up the workload, you know, who was going to do what, who was going to work on what editing, and so on and so forth. And there was a guy, and he raised his hand, and he said, I can't read and I can't write, but I can cook. And if each of you will give me $3 a day. I'll fix you some good meals. And he did. I mean, that guy was so special. I mean, it was so special that he had the courage to do that. How many of us would have been able to do that? He only had a few months. He didn't have that much time. And by the way, Bob B tells me he's still clean today. You know, there were times when we would start, it was insane. We would start early in the morning, like maybe 6 o'clock or 7 or 8, and we'd work till midnight or 1 o'clock, and then we'd get a few hours sleep and we'd do it again. I came back from Ohio with bronchitis. I came back from Florida with pneumonia. But I could not stay away from that book. It was a miracle. It really was our book. In Florida, they voted on what they were going to call it. And a lot of us who worked on it, a lot of us who dreamed about it, a lot of us who talked about it over the years, always thought it would be called our book. And we were in Florida, and there was a guy who didn't have very much time, and he raised his hand, and he said, you know, what is it? It's a basic text of how to recover. We all looked at each other, yeah, it's on. So there was no more debate. It was like one of those spontaneous things, and everybody decided to call it that. I'm going to talk a little bit about language, and I think Bill talked a little bit about that before. You know, I grew up with, I came to the program, and somewhere along the line, the powers that be, it had evolved that we would say clean and sober. If you said clean and you didn't say sober, somebody would tell you about that. And I think that was an outgrowth of so many of us come from that it's okay to drink, if just be clean. And a lot of others of us come from, I came from every time I used, it began and ended with alcohol. So it was important, or it was thought important. I thought it was important. So I said clean and sober, and I said, I used the language of, I used that language because that was the language that was in vogue at the time. And then there was a movement, I think it was, well, wasn't it around late 70s? That language started changing, and people felt like we needed our own language, and that to say clean and sober was like saying I'm clean and clean. And I agreed with that, I really did. But a lot of people really tried to ram it down people's throats. You know, it was kind of an in-your-face thing, and I just really hated that. And for me, it was hard. You know, once you learn something, it's hard to unlearn it. So I would lapse into, and then I would be ridiculed and humiliated and all of that. I could take it because I had enough time to be able to do that. And I was in the process of changing it, so I didn't feel bad about it. But I felt bad about for the newcomers coming in who got that, and for the people who who were having trouble with it. And a lot of people, because of that, because of the aggressiveness and the in-your-face of it, said clean and sober and, you know, the hell with you the rest of their lives. And some people still say that. And I, for me, I try to be very tolerant. And that's pretty hard because I'm not very tolerant. But I really try to be tolerant. And I also have this little nasty, sarcastic side of me. And sometimes it comes out, and I don't really mean to, but it does. You know, an example of that was when I argued for an edit for the book in Florida, and I thought I argued quite passionately and quite eloquently, and I was having a good day that day. And it was ill-received, to say the least. You know, it was like, well, you can't change. We can't do that because it'll change This book is the conscious, group consciousness, Narcotics Anonymous, and you can't change anything. And if you edit it, you'll change anything. It's like changing God's word. So I said, God, as I understand, God is not illiterate. That was the little nasty side of me, but anyway. You know, and it's funny because years later it did get edited, and it was pretty much of a disaster. I don't know if anybody knows about that. But what happened was, it wasn't deliberate or anything, but the person who typed the copy for the professional editor was having problems like we often do, and they were distracted and they left out paragraphs and they left out pages and they left out stuff. And of course when I discovered that, I could just hear those people on the floor just saying stuff to me. See, Sally, we told you. But that got taken care of. How am I doing time-wise? Okay, I said that I would talk. I guess I just rambled all over the place. I hope that was okay. Now I will take questions. No? My gosh.
Here we go.
Yes. And then you.
You mentioned Chuck Skinner.
Yes.
And I just wonder, I hear a lot about him, but nothing specific. What, I know he was close to Jimmy, too.
Yeah.
What role did he play in his early days?
Chuck was a member of the Board of Trustees from its inception on, and he was a really beautiful person. I'm like somebody who tends to intellectualize things. I'll see something and I'll see 25 sides of it. And when I came in, I had a really severe common sense deficiency. And Chuck had... I still have a little bit of that. And Chuck had the ability, Chuck had so much common sense, and he could just cut through all the bullshit to the heart of the matter. And Chuck loved Jimmy, and when this stuff happened between the office and the trustees, Chuck was really heartbroken about that. And he went down and he tried to talk to Jimmy 3 times, and Jimmy wouldn't let him in the house. And the last time he was beating on the door screaming, open the goddamn door, I know you're in there. And Chuck was really hurt by that. I think that time period was a very painful time. It was a wonderful time, it was an exciting time because we got a book out of it. But it was a very painful time for everybody involved. And we all did the best we could, and you know, it came out okay. Because when I went to San Diego, I could just see what healing had taken place. It was just magical what healing had taken place. Okay, somebody in the back had, yes.
Hi, I'm Francine.
Hi, Francine.
The question has been asked generally about the people about the vision.
Uh-huh.
Talking specifically about the book. Since you're talking specifically about the book,
uh-huh,
would appreciate, what would be your vision for, quote-unquote, our book,
Vedic Text? Ah, that's lovely. I hope I can answer it. I would like to see it translated into all of the languages where we have meetings. I would like to see it, you know, when the board went to one board, I was really worried about that. I did what little I could to derail it. And then I just prayed about it and let it go. And I was afraid that we would end up with a book, you know, 50 years from now that was a little antiquated and had some terminology that, I was afraid it would get rigid. And we're a living, breathing, growing fellowship. And I'd like to see the book be a living, breathing, growing book. Yes.
My name is Joe Amatic.
Yes.
Why were there five editions?
Oh, geez. Okay.
Because I've heard that it was the process that I heard. No, it was the content. There was wordsmith, you know. I've heard different things.
Okay, Jimmy didn't want to print the book the way it was turned into him, and that the way it was in the second edition. He didn't want to print that because he thought there were errors in tradition 4 and 9. And I think that those were errors in 4 and 9. So the trustees, and I think WSO, the chair of the trustees, the chair of WSO, and the chair of WSC, that's my understanding anyway. I wasn't there, so the people who were there would have to tell you that. But what Chuck told me is that they signed that, giving Jimmy the authorization to leave out a couple of things in 4 and 9. And those things had to do with the way the wording was that, I tried to explain this to somebody the other day, and they said, that's just too esoteric for me. So, but anyway, the way the wording was, it put the service structure outside of Narcotics Anonymous. That the service structure is not Narcotics Anonymous and not a part of Narcotics Anonymous. So if that's the case, it would not make the service, it would make the service structure not subject to the traditions. And Jimmy was really big on the traditions, and he couldn't in good conscience print that book that way. So he had the authorization, he took it to the printer. And a lot of people urged Jimmy to get competitive bids. And Jimmy was a very loyal guy, and he went with the printer that had always printed the stuff for us. And that printer, that was a big job, and he'd always done small jobs for us. Well, he took our $25,000 down payment and got loaded. And so then the whole Board of Trustees had to make that decision, and there was a firestorm over it, just an incredible firestorm. Chuck told me there was going to be, and when he made that authorization, he told me, I'm going to take the heat for it, I'm going to resign from the Board of Trustees, I'm going to say I did it, and it had nothing to do with any of you, and I can preserve the integrity of the board. Well, that didn't happen because the board had to pick it again. Then, when the conference rolls around, I thought they were going to fire the trustees for doing it. I really did. I was fully prepared for that. It was okay. And they kept the trustees, and they put the material back in. Then a year later, when Peppers had kind of eased off a bit, they changed it again. So that was 3. And then the edit that got messed up was 4. And the edit that didn't get messed up was 5. Okay, so there are your, that's it in a nutshell. I can do a lot more to it than that. Yes? Yes.
Were you in WSC during 1990, 91, 92, and that period?
No.
Okay. Well, that question was more. Thank you.
Yes.
I heard things about a certain italicized portions of the book. Someone told me that it had some special significance, such as the service prayer, God grant me knowledge, and the preface, that little,
full
food to make a lot of losing heart. Mm-hmm. Is there some significance to the
Think that was just a way of highlighting it. I'm not positive about that. Is that right, Bill?
Right, that's right.
I remember that now. The white book. The inclusions in the basic text from the white book were italicized. Were highlighted in that fashion. Thanks. Okay, I have 5 minutes. Anybody else?
Yes, the microphone's right here.
Mm-hmm.
My question is this. Being the original literature review chair and everybody seemed to be so interested in the literature, I thought I'd take this opportunity to ask, what would you suggest that I do to get more people involved in the literature that's up and coming? For instance, the we currently have coming out in the 2004 CAR, the sponsorship draft book. And I've got that book right now for the new, we're about to have the sponsorship book. There, the world is coming out with a book on sponsorship. I mean, I don't know how many people know that, but there's actually a book on sponsorship that they're creating. I mean, there's always more literature coming. So what can I do as a literature review chair for the district? For the district, get more people involved with something like that.
I think make it as known as you can, and then find people that are willing to get involved, that have sponsees, and get your sponsees to come. And then it just grows from there. The more people you get, the more people you get. It's kind of a snowball thing. And a lot of times, when I was new, I got dragged to a lot of stuff just because that's what somebody with some time told me to do. So get your sponsees involved. And when you get people with not very much time who are new involved, it creates an excitement, and it's a chance to tie newcomers into the program. Am I done?
No, one more. So what year was that the initial review started for the book?
The book was written it was published in 83. It was sent out for approval in 82, and it was written in 81. Is that right? Is that the sequence? I'm not real good on dates, but I think that's
right. The book came out in February of 81 for review to the fellowship. The approval form of the basic text came out in November of 81 and was fully distributed to the fellowship.
That's right, it was published in the 83. Yes. Did you have your hand up? Yeah, you look pretty good.
Well, actually, it's kind of unfair at this point to ask you the question, because it may take a little while, but what actually is, I think that whole era when Jimmy was in the office,
uh-huh.
And Jimmy wasn't in the
yes.
office, and that whole us and them thing.
Right. Can I have a little more time?
Yes.
Okay, the thing with the book happened, and people were really unhappy about the loss of that $25,000, and it was felt that we were growing, and that Jimmy, it was so painful at the time. It's so painful for all of us, and nobody did anything to anybody. Things happened. The fellowship made the decision that the office needed more professional management. And so they appointed somebody. They told the WSO board of directors to find somebody professional to take the office. And so Jimmy was offered the opportunity to resign. And he did, in fact, resign. That's how that happened. No. Yes.
I'm Ryan. Okay. I heard a fellow last week in Illinois that they packed Jimmy's stuff up in a box, took it to his house, and set it on his floor, and drank the lot. That's the office right here.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that. There were a lot of things that got said and a lot of accusations got thrown back and forth, and a lot of people were angry. I know that before I ever came to the trustees, there was bad blood between the literature committee and Jimmy, and I'm not sure exactly what that was about. I think that the literature committee attempted to revise another look and made a couple of changes, and Jimmy said that it was either going to get published the way he had written it or he would take it and the fellowship would never see it again. So they took it the way it was, but there was just a lot of stuff. And I know that when I was working in World Lit sent him all the drafts of the books. Am I right, though? They sent him all the drafts of the book, and they really tried to involve him. They called him, and he just didn't want to have anything to do with Lit. I don't know whether that was because he felt that they should just do it on their own, or whether there was something there. I don't know about that story. I know all of the people involved, and I know that the people involved would have tried to treat Jimmy with as much respect as they possibly could, given the bad situation. And there was stuff on every side. There was no right or wrong. There was no real bad guy in any of this. Yes.